And welcome back to Backbone Radio. This is Krista Kafer. I'm sitting in for Ross Kaminsky. Thank you again, Eddie, the producer behind the board. And I'm over here rocking out to this song. I love it. I love songs about freedom because that's what we're all about here at Backbone Radio. Our next guest is Bill Maloney. He is the former state commissioner. He served from 1997 to 2007. He has his doctorate in educational management from Harvard. He's been a principal, a teacher, a superintendent in several states, as well as the education commissioner here. He's also a friend of mine and a fellow at the Centennial Institute. I had the pleasure of meeting Bill back in Washington, back when I worked for Bob Schaefer. I'm going to get all nostalgic now, but I worked for Bob, and I met Bill back in 1998, I believe, and when he and some of our elected state board members had come out for a visit, and I've had the privilege of knowing him since. Bill, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be with you, my fellow, Krista.
Fellow. Well, you recently wrote a report for the Centennial Institute called Much Better Schools on Much Lower Budgets, A Primer for Colorado Policymakers. I've got it right here in front of me. It's eminently readable and full of some fascinating facts and I think a few surprises. You start off the paper by taking a look at some myths, actually three myths that people hold true to until they're told otherwise. Tell us a little bit about those.
Well, there are such a variety of these myths, but the first is one that we're doing real well educationally. We're not. As the recent statistics released by the U.S. government showed recently, and this paper indicates that in terms of other countries, our international competitors, we're 35th in math, 29th in science, 18th in reading. The recent figures that came out from the U.S. Department of Education confirmed that with some variation. So that's number one that we are doing well. And the second, or certainly a major one, is that, gee, there's no one who could do it better than this, when in fact there are an abundance of models near and far in this country, in this state, and beyond that are doing better. Those are the countries that are ahead of us. And so many people are, let's say, concerned about, oh my gosh, if we cut education, that's the end of reform. And that's nonsense. This is a golden opportunity for reform. So myths abound, and these are things we have known for a very long time, but we chose not to look at them. Now, what just a couple of years ago was a deep mystery suddenly is the conventional wisdom.
So these are not only myths, they're sort of sacred cows, things that we haven't touched or questioned until now. You make the case that having to cut $1 billion to balance our budget here in Colorado, that we actually have an opportunity to do things a little bit differently. And that's kind of the premise of your paper. And you take apart some of those, like you slay some of those sacred cows by really hitting point by point with the achievement statistics, other sort of misconceptions, and then go into a part of the paper that talks about solutions. And let's go ahead and flip over to that part now and take a look at some of those solutions. And also, I think even before that, looking at some of the solutions that have been tried that aren't really solutions at all. You raise the issue of class size reduction. I think if you took a poll of the average person down the street, they'd say, oh, class size reduction is a terrific thing. Why is it not a terrific thing?
It's not a terrific thing for three reasons. One, the research is absolutely clear that smaller class size does no good whatsoever in terms of student achievement. Number two, the cost of class size reduction has been absolutely horrendous. Even if it did work, the trade-off would not be worth the tremendous costs. And thirdly, all of the top schools in the world have twice the class size we have, and they're still, you know, knocking our socks off. So there's just no case to be made for it, unless, of course, you are a special interest that knows that smaller class size means, let's say, more staff. More staff means more members of the union. More members of the union means more dues. More dues means more political clout and so forth. It's just astounding the price we have paid. California has lurched into bankruptcy over this issue. Take an example there. Between 1995 and 1998, on a class size mandate, they increased their teaching force from 62,000 to 91,000. And their results got even worse. So anywhere you want to look, this is just a loser. And people are waking up to this. I mean, all of the money in education, in any industry, goes to personnel. And as Paul Samuelson of the Washington Post pointed out recently, between 1955 and 2008, at a time when student enrollment increased only 8%, the number of teachers increased 61%. What this means is we saw a precipitous decline in the productivity of U.S. education. Now, under the hammer of necessity, let's say, with this looming fiscal catastrophe every state is facing, people are waking up and saying, gee, maybe that wasn't a good idea. Locally, you're seeing that sort of thing. Superintendent in Aurora now has assigned secondary teachers 6 classes a day to teach instead of 5. That's a 20% increase in productivity right there. Now, if you increase the class size at secondary, say from 20 to 25, combined with going to 5 to 6, that is a 50% increase in productivity at no cost and no detriment, let's say, to achievement. Kind of hard to argue with that.
I think it's very hard to argue with, and really an excellent point. You also bring up compensation and the fact that in other professions, people are paid what they're worth. But in this profession, among teachers, there is a unitary salary scale that applies to most public school teachers. Here in Colorado, we have Senator Michael Johnson, who has tackled that with a new merit pay law. Do you think that law goes far enough?
No, it's a step in the right direction, but let's say it really only nibbles around the edge of the problem that we have with the entire issue of teacher recruitment, teacher evaluation, teacher compensation, teacher retention. Senator Johnson's bill, let's say, makes some useful moves relative to evaluation, but it doesn't get at the fundamental problem, is that while other nations recruit only the best and the brightest into our classrooms, we have no comparable national policy, and people are essentially self-selected. Until you really address quality, until you do on a mass scale what is done on a small scale by, say, something like Teach for America, which literally brings the best and the brightest into our classrooms, or the outstanding internship and residency teacher recruitment programs in Boston, Chicago, and New York, which have shown astonishing results, until you get at the root causes, kind of fooling around with the evaluation process, and you know, this is going to take years. I mean, you know how the legislation is.
Oh, it moves glacially. So this is a little bit like tinkering with the chairs on the Titanic. We need something a little bit more robust to save us from sinking. I'm also intrigued by your discussion over education being underfunded, and we have a chance to talk about that a little bit now, but then we'll have to go to a break and move into the issue a little bit more. You talked quite a bit at length about the student-staff ratios and how those have dropped over time, but I imagine there are other things to that myth.
Yes, and here in Colorado, you see an example of that. One still sees these bumper stickers, Colorado 49th in education spending, which is disingenuous to begin with because they are measuring spending against wealth, which is like saying, poor Bill Gates, he only drives a Lexus. He has inadequate transportation because he could afford a Rolls Royce.
But you know what? Let's take this issue apart a little bit more when we get back. We're going to go to a break now, so everybody stay tuned. We'll be back in mere minutes.
For full offer, see Sears.com. See price matching policy for details.
Welcome back to Backbone Radio. This is Krista Kafer filling in for Ross Kaminsky. And that excellent tune you hear in the background, that is from Devotchka. And even more specifically, that scrumptious tuba sound is my friend Jeannie Schroeder. And we'll be hearing from her later on the radio show. Right now, we've got Bill Maloney, former education commissioner, here on the line, discussing his new paper. And I want to tell you folks how to get a hold of this paper, because I highly recommend reading it. If you go to the Centennial Institute, and I'll confess, I'm kind of a lazy Google user, so I just, you know, type in Centennial Institute, and it'll take you to a page where you can access this paper in PDF, download it, and read it. I think it is something that not just every lawmaker should read, but also the citizens, because I think the more informed we are, the more likely we will be to hold our elected officials to account, and also to work with our friends, neighbors, and family, people who still hold on to some of these sacred cows, letting them know that, you know what, it may seem this way, but the truth, the facts, they spell otherwise. When we left for a commercial break, we were talking about the goofy bumper sticker that alleges that Colorado is behind in funding. And I think the Independence Institute did a series of papers that knocked that myth out of the water. I want to point to or take a look at one of the states that you highlighted in your paper as a state that's doing more with less. What state is that?
That was Utah, our neighbor up to the northwest. And the reason they're doing better by National Assessment of Educational Progress can be attributed to a number of things, but one in particular is a powerful focus on teacher quality. However, the main driver that makes their cost lower, and Utah spends just 61 cents for every dollar that Colorado spends, the main driver is the average class size in Utah is 23.7, whereas in Colorado it's 16.8. Now, rough calculation, the difference between the two, if Colorado went to 23.7, would be well over $300 million. Do you think that might come in handy, the legislature making a budget this year? Now, of course, it is not within legislature purview to do that, but here is an example of a state that is modeling itself more on the top foreign nations than, let's say, the approach that, while favored, let's say, by unions, makes no sense in terms of educational productivity.
You know, much like in other countries and with the private sector, much of my experience has been looking at charter schools, and many of the people that I know that are in the charter school movement are charter school teachers. And one thing that's kind of interesting there is that bad teachers get fired. There is no tenure. Consequently, my friends who are good teachers do well in their profession, but the people that come in that really aren't fit for that kind of work, they just, you know, they get shown the door. I think it's interesting that you highlighted some of the private schools and what they're doing, and it seems to me that they've got a similar approach to hiring quality and letting go low quality. Tell us a little bit about the information you found out about the state's Catholic schools.
Well, here again, there bears a certain resemblance in terms of productivity to Utah. The Denver Archdiocese, which is the largest number of Catholic schools in our state, they come in at 55% of the cost of what public schools in Colorado. Now, admittedly, let's say they do not have the breadth of options. They do not have 82 electives in every high school. They do not have two Olympic swimming pools. But it is a widely admired form of education that lots of people would like to get their kids into if they could afford it. And you have to look at that, particularly the superb record they have had in dealing with minorities and with youngsters, let's say, who have struggled in the public schools. I think the average parent would say, yeah, I could go for that, and if it might lower my tax rate too, that is definitely win-win. So you don't have to go abroad to find the example. A lot of people say, oh, well, those foreign countries, you know, they're so different, they look alike, and so forth. However, look right here. Look at the Sunshine Kip Academy. Look at Kip schools all across the country. That's the Knowledge is Power program. They specialize in large class size and an absolutely total focus on moving poor kids on to college. You go out to that school and every kid is wearing a t-shirt that says climbing the mountain to college. If you're ever feeling depressed as an educator, just go out there and spend an hour and watch what's going on. So there are lots of places right close to home if we would choose to look at them. But there has been an almost conscious determination to look away and say, oh, well, that really doesn't count. When, in fact, the ones who don't want you to look at them are the special interests who don't want to own up to the reality that schools like that, who don't build the well-being of the child around the professional comfort of the adult, what they can do. I think now, let's say, under the hammer of necessity, you look at inaugural addresses by governors around the country, including people not known for their frugality, like Jerry Brown in California or Andrew Cuomo in New York. They seem like they're channeling Ronald Reagan now in what they're talking about in finance and saying that public sector unions must be stopped. Whoa, my God, think of the trouble you could get into a couple of years ago if Republicans said that, and now the Democrats are all saying it. They have no choice. That's why Governor Ritter last year, when Senator Keith King pointed the way to a reinterpretation of the factors surrounding Amendment 23, which ratchets spending up year after year, if we interpret it this way, that's $260 million less. I think I'll go for it. You're going to see a lot of that.
Necessity is making people a bit more receptive. You've got, I think you go all the way through the alphabet in looking at very specific, concrete examples from other states as well as from foreign countries on things that could be done. And in the final part of your paper, you talk about some very concrete things that the legislature could do now. We've only got about a minute left, but I was wondering if you could spell some of those out for us.
Well, what the legislature can do is go after some of the structural problems we have. The single largest one are entitlements, particularly pensions. And here again, I think this is the conventional wisdom now. Everyone realizes these have gotten out of hand. The Colorado version, PERA, they looked at it last year. They've got to look at it again this year. There are numerous things they can do. Going to tuition tax credits, as Arizona did, can result in major savings. Getting rid of the obstacles to efficiency, mainly in the regulatory sector, can help a great deal. Opening the door wider for privatization, as per the bill that Senator Nancy Spence is sponsoring.
We're coming up on the end of time. I hate to do this to you, so I'm going to go ahead and say goodbye and wish everyone to go to the Centennial Institute website and check out this must-read paper.
All right. Enjoyed
Thank you
it.
So much.
You take care.